Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello and welcome to Friday. Oh, blessed Friday with Brett Ehrlich.
Hi. Full disclosure, Brett's having vertigo today.
Yeah.
So if I fall out of the chair, that's why.
Yeah.
And or John might have told an amazingly funny joke.
That's
one
probably
of those
what
two,
it is.
One compounded by the other.
Yeah.
It's weird, man. See my eyes jumping around, that's why.
You know, the funny thing about this, so we believe in like radical honesty. So I remember, I don't know, 6 months ago, I was really depressed and I started off a show by letting people know that it's gonna color the show. Like I can try to control it, but I'm crazy depressed. And you are like, forget that. I might vomit or pass out in any given second. What is the show gonna be like in a year? It's just gonna be like two caskets.
Yeah, here's what's left of John and Brett. If you shake the box, yeah. It says something.
And by the way, great start to Valentine's Day for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, happy Valentine's Day. My wife had to drive me to work today.
That's what she wants. It's the normal tradition.
Love you, hun.
Yeah, wake up.
And I forgot my wedding ring at home.
Hey. Wait, I hesitate to say this because she might be watching. I also forgot my wedding ring, but I have backups. Yeah. I have backups.
My backups, I guess, probably are all here. God, we're terrible husbands.
Okay, I mean that's the mood of the day.
Bye, everybody.
See ya.
Watch Happy Half Hour today at whatever damn time it's at. 5 p.m. for our live streams. Oh 7 p.m. for live linear offerings.
And, oh, jeez.
Sam Dingman is on and he's a podcast. He had produced.
I heard he had fun.
We had a really good time.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, I'm not gonna do a full preview. We got two candidates, gonna be awesome. Also, every Friday now ends, thankfully, with our Brett and I choosing our garbage people of the week. I'm very enthusiastic about mine this week and I'm excited to find out what Brett's is. So definitely stick around for the end of the show for that. But why don't we start off with a bit more on Valentine's Day?
Yes.
On Fox and Friends this morning, they were talking about Valentine's Day, and Brian Kilmeade had a take on it that was weird, but also like a little bit sad. Take a look.
By the way, I have an unofficial poll that says Valentine's Day is America's favorite holiday. It even beats Christmas. They didn't poll me. I'm just saying, how could it beat Christmas? But I mean, and we made up this holiday. It's not really real.
Fox and Friends?
Fox and Friends.
One way to do a live studio.
But America made up this holiday and now we love it so much.
It's such a weird thing. Like I don't even know where to start with it. Like we made it, well there is Saint Valentine. He's trying to say the thing that everybody says, which is like Hallmark made this holiday up to sell greeting cards.
You think that's what he means?
I think that's what, that's the kind of dummy he is. I almost said
you
a
think
bad
he
word.
Means we made it up recently.
He's the kind of dummy that kind of repeats things he's heard before.
Mm-hmm.
And he probably heard, you know, they just made up Valentine's Day to sell greeting cards. That's like a cliche that people share and it's fun and it makes you seem interesting. He almost remembers that.
Yeah.
And so he's like, we made it up. America did.
So it would be like if I was like someone's like they got their engagement ring and I'm like, we just made up diamonds.
No, it's not like that.
Well, it's a new tradition. Most people don't know how recent that is.
Right. Well, anyway. Okay, got you. Yes, that's right. Because St. Valentine has a feast day and I think he facilitated communication by people in prison and that was like some, I forget what the whole thing was.
I did not know that.
It is tangentially related to Valentine's Day, which is now, look at the imagery, it's all cherubs from like ancient Rome mythology.
Yeah.
As evidenced by this.
What is going on? on.
This pick. So Brett's helping produce the show today too. So
I don't want it.
I rated our free B-roll archive at pixabay.com.
And why is it launching hearts?
It's this gonad-free cherub launching hearts at you.
We just made that up though.
Yeah, we just.
Oh my God. Anyway, look, you've pretty much convinced me that's what it means. But just in case, because it's Brian Kilmeade and it's Fox and Friends, we can't know for sure. All the holidays are made up, all of them.
Yeah.
Some are older. It's like when someone will be like, there's like a newer religion, and they're like, this is a made up religion. Well, yeah,
so
but
yours,
they're
bro.
All made up. Like that word's made up. No, they're all made up. It's all invented. Nothing's real. Some is older, and I get that that makes it seem more plausible.
Right.
For both religions and holidays, actually.
A word is a sound slightly less ridiculous than a name.
Anyway, I did want to mention one other thing because we cut off that clip. That's like when I wanted the clip to cut. But they do keep talking for a bit. And in it, Ainsley Earhart says, and it's like just an American thing. Like, did you know in France they have Valentine's Day, but it's just for kids? And like I heard that, and I don't know enough about French culture to say whether that's true or not. But our producer Angel was angry at that portrayal of French holidays, and she was like, "That's ridiculous. Yes, it is for kids, but adults can do it too."
It's ridiculous. They should also like take pride in just their ethos. They should take pride in every other country that moderately adopts something that we mm-hmm. like started evangelizing, and
yeah.
that's like Halloween, mm-hmm. the way we do it. Like they do it in Japan. It is huge.
Yeah,
and the big intersection from all the movies is flooded with literally a million people in costumes.
Yeah.
They should be like, nailed it.
Nailed it.
They
Soft
should
power.
Be like, oh, great. But he's like this weird fake. They're both religious holidays, too. Mm-hmm. It's Saint Valentine.
Yeah. Yeah, the weird thing
spike
is.
Spike your football, bud.
Like, I have that thing where, like, I have to make sure that he knows that they're all made up. But I just want to be clear. I like love all of our holidays.
Yeah.
I think they're great. I think that they're utterly meaningless in any sense other than social, but they're great and I love them and that's all it needs.
What's your favorite ridiculous holiday that's like not Christmas or Thanksgiving or Halloween?
Well, I really do like or any of them.
Sorry.
Well, I like Christmas. I mean,
so
look,
Christmas
I think 4th of July is cool. I think in my mind a holiday that I've invented is really cool. Where we got to move on soon, but
no,
Halloween is great.
I will not leave until I hear this.
Shut up. Halloween is great for a lot of reasons, but one is that like as an adult, unless you do cosplay, you don't get to dress up, but you do on Halloween. It's fun. You get to choose. It says something about you. But that's like the only dress up holiday.
Purim.
I think. What's that?
Anti-Semite. There's Purim.
Do they?
Yeah. It's Jewish Halloween.
I take back everything.
You want more? You want
no,
more?
No, I want 6 months before Halloween so that they're evenly distributed. There should be a sort of traditional, like, masquerade holiday. There's no masquerade holiday.
All right.
Where, like, that's what you do. You don't go out and trick or treat. It's just everybody has a big masquerade party. You, like, have a cool outfit, you make a mask or whatever. That should be a holiday. Like, and how do we make it one? Because. The only way that holidays come about is someone's like, this would be cool.
Find other total perverts like you, I guess.
No, it's not.
Well, Jun-chan, this March 19th for Eyes Wide Shut Eve.
Uh-huh. On that holiday, you know what you do? You forget your wedding ring. Anyway, okay, let's move on. I don't know what's going on in the show today. Okay, let's move on to Chris Matthews. Earlier this week, Chris Matthews, in the wake of, I believe it was New Hampshire, was very worried about what it could mean if Bernie Sanders becomes the nominee and becomes president. You might have missed this clip, so just in case, here's what he said back then.
I remember the Cold War. I have an attitude towards Castro. I believe if Castro and the Reds had won the Cold War, there would have been executions in Central Park, and I might have been one of the ones getting executed. And certain other people would be there cheering, okay? So I have a problem with people who took the other side. I don't know who Bernie supports over these years. I don't know what he means by social. One week it's Denmark. We're going to be like Denmark. Okay, that's harmless. That's basically a capitalist country with a lot of good social welfare programs. Denmark is harmless.
It's pretty clearly in the Denmark.
Is he?
Category, yeah.
Are you sure? How do you know? Did he tell you that?
Well, I mean, that's what he says, and that's what his agenda calls for, right?
That like that panel is Thanksgiving dinner, and Chris Hayes is like the guy trying to deal with like his great uncle,
mm-hmm.
who's just like, come on, Dad, come on. Yeah, no, he's not gonna be executing people in Central Park. That's insanity. And again, like, Chris Matthews is sort of like a laughable figure in comparison to like Chuck Todd or something. But like, both of them have effectively said that Bernie Sanders, who calls for like healthcare, housing, and student loan cancellation, his thing is killing people effectively.
Yeah, it's also like this weird flex that you've got from Chris Matthews. We're like, you know what? I would have been the executed one.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, it's what are you
prospective
doing?
Victimhood.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's weird too. Anyway, look, I do want to catch you up on this because last night Michael Moore was on Chris Matthews' show and he attempted to reassure him that he's not going to be killed.
You're always welcome here. Spread the word among the Bernie people. We want the surrogates like Ro Khanna. We want Tina Turner.
Yes,
please come again,
come
and again and again
and
again.
And we want to assure you, we will never take you into Central Park and do any harm to you.
Yeah, just, I knew that was coming. You and I can argue about that at a different place, but you're always on. And by the way, whatever my opinions are, don't ask me. I say, but don't ask me. This place is for the argument, not for my views. Thank you so much.
We love you, Chris.
30 years.
Thank you, Michael Moore.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next.
About the argument, not his views, but my view is that I might have been killed if the like he has views and he says them constantly, all the time.
Yeah, but it's also like Americans had certain foreign policy during the Cold War that resulted in tons of people being rounded up in stadiums in South America and being murdered.
That's true.
Like we did that. So, but like, what a weird point to make. I get it, but they have a genuine fear, two genuine fears. One, that Bernie Sanders is a communist. Mm-hmm. And two, that they'll have another like, whatever, like, I forget who it was now, like the near Muskie eight farts. Like they're afraid that they will have a too liberal nominee that like the Republicans had with Goldwater will result in an embarrassing loss. Mm-hmm. But what they forget
like
is
Corbin or something like that. Like their
embarrassing
specter.
Loss. Their embarrassing loss last time. No, it's Humphreys or someone like that. McGovern. One of those. Yeah. Like when you look at the Reagan map, he only won Minnesota.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
And that was it. They're afraid of that.
Yeah. And okay, fine. You can be afraid of that. I mean, I would say look at the poll data. You're not going to do that. So that's fine. But you're not going to be killed. You're seriously not going to be killed. Nobody cares. Like Chris Matthews, like I have a lot of issues with him. Nobody wants to see him slapped harshly, let alone killed. It's not going to happen. It's crazy. Also, when Michael Moore tried to like reassure him, he said, we can talk about that at another place. Like just, I get that he's not necessarily saying he still believes it, but that sort of feeds into the idea that he still does. And finally, because we have to move on. It's Nina Turner. It's not Tina Turner.
What?
Tina Turner is not, as far as I know, a Sanders surrogate. That's how could you not know that? So weird. Anyway, okay, let's take a break. If you can, who's gonna join us after this?
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of On the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Now joining us once again, congressional candidate for Washington's 5th District, Chris Armitage. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Happy to be here, John. Appreciate it. Happy Valentine's Day.
And happy Valentine's Day to you as well. It's been a little bit since we spoke. The campaign has obviously continued to develop. Could you catch us up a bit on how things are going out there?
Yeah, they're going really incredible. We've added to our list of endorsements. So now we have Our Revolution on top of Brand New Congress, on top of the Washington State Bernie-crats, Washington State Progressive Caucus, and quite a few other organizations.
Actually, can I ask a question about that? We talk about endorsements quite a bit when we have candidates on, but from your point of view as the candidate, when like an Our Revolution endorses you, what does that actually mean? Why is that as important as it is?
That's a really good question. I mean, different groups come with different benefits. Our Revolution pretty much means that we mostly Bernie supporters get brought to a lot of down ballot candidates. It gets us a lot more attention. After Super Tuesday, we're going to end up with a lot of folks who are currently canvassing for the Sanders campaign and receiving a lot of training for that, coming over to our campaign. And then Brand New Congress, they're a particularly helpful endorsement because they're a group, they're one of the first groups that worked with Representative Ocasio-Cortez. Mm-hmm. And they find working class candidates and help them get elected. And you can only be nominated. I believe they received about 20,000 nominations this election cycle. They've chosen around 30 candidates. And wow. So it's an honor to be on the slate. And we do weekly training and they're really helping us set up staff and a lot of resources that just working class people running for office aren't going to have without a nationwide collective effort.
And that's so important because there have been versions of that for more traditional candidates for a very long time. They're all over the place, they're well funded, they've existed for a very long time. But we're still in the relative first steps of setting up a sort of infrastructure for candidates on the left. So it's great to see that they are, especially with so many people being nominated, that they're doing as well as they are in choosing candidates and helping push them past the goal line. So I did want to ask you, I saw that you recently signed the Code Pink Pledge. Can you tell us about that and why you chose to sign it?
Absolutely. As a veteran, divesting from war is one of the most important things that I can support. I am a member of Veterans for Peace, and I was speaking to some of those folks, and there are gentlemen there who were drafted into Vietnam, people who served in Korea, in the Gulf War, and then folks like me who are part of Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And we ask ourselves, when we were on the verge of war with Iran just a few weeks ago, how do we stop this from happening again? I was 9 years old when 9/11 happened. I was out protesting it a few years later. And then a few years after that, I was enlisting myself because it was my best shot at actually being able to go to college without crippling student loan debt and finally having good insurance and a living wage. So how do we stop from repeating this cycle? Clearly, just hitting the streaks isn't enough. And it really came down to a few different things. One, mobilizing and organizing so that we can affect the outcome of elections. And two, pushing government at every single level to commit to divesting our taxpayer dollars from organizations connected to the military-industrial complex. It shouldn't be profitable to go out to send our young people to war to die or to kill people on the other side of the world.
Yeah. And I know sort of around that, you've recently unveiled your platform when it comes to foreign policy. Can you give us a few of the highlights on that?
Sure. So a big part of that is investing more money into foreign service officers so that we can increase our diplomatic ties, making bases like Kuwait, our bases in Kuwait, more permanent, similar to how we have them in Korea, mm-hmm. so that spending less money over there, and it creates more steady organization there. And that also allows us to fully withdraw from Afghanistan. It's foreign policy is a difficult thing as a progressive because, we can say, how do we feel about the environment? And no, we have the Green New Deal to stand by as the gold standard. How do we feel about healthcare? Single payer, Medicare for all, that's the gold standard. Foreign policy hasn't been something that we've been able to really make as cut and dry because I'm not an isolationist. If people need help, we should try and help them. But also we need to find a way to end all these forever wars.
Okay. And one thing I wanted to ask was I was looking over the schedule and your primary is actually, it's August 4th, quite a bit later than some of these others. I mean, there are some candidates who, Super Tuesday, that's their congressional primary. Your schedule is very different. And so far, it looks like in terms of your opposition, it's been pretty much the same. You have a pretty good idea of how that's gonna go. This shifted timeline, how does that affect the way your campaign strategy, the way that you're going about this run?
It gives us a lot more time for outreach. Mm-hmm. Right now, today, we have a really unique race here. I'm the sole challenger as a first-time candidate, to an entrenched Republican who's running for their ninth term. And so that extra time gives us a chance to build more of an organization. We've done so much learning over the last few months. We have incredible folks. Sarah Smith, who ran in CD9 in Washington State in 2018, she has now come onto our campaign. We've been able to just find incredible people. And so one thing that we're doing with that extra time is next month, we're going to be visiting every single incorporated town and reservation in the district, which is our district's 25% bigger than New Jersey. So it's a lot of area to cover. And so we're going to drive up and down this district. I mean, it goes up from the Canadian border down to Oregon, easily a 5-hour drive.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of these towns have never ever had someone running for Congress visit them. And once you get into that one-on-one that extra time affords us, you can really break through the Fox News red versus blue bubble and actually connect with people.
Okay. Well, we're definitely going to find out how that goes. Up until then, how can people find out more about your run?
Well, I would definitely tell them they should check out our Twitter, @RealArmy, Army with an I, and our Facebook, which is just Armitage for Congress, ARMITAGE, and armitageforcongress.com. We're in a single digit red district. Every election cycle, we push it closer and closer to being not controlled by a Republican. My opponent is Trump's Washington State fundraising chair.
Yeah.
And I actually had the opportunity a few weeks ago to visit the ICE detention facility in Tacoma, Washington, met with an amazing woman named Carlina. I asked her if I could use her name, and she said, go ahead, I'm not scared of them. She leads hunger strikes out there. They have maggots in the food. They maybe get one shower a week. She said there's been screws and rocks in the food too. They get dirty clothes to wear. It's a horrific situation. She leads hunger strikes. She organizes the detainees. And my opponent helps fund those facilities. She supports their existence.
Wow.
And so, like I said, this is a single digit red district. And so if anyone can chip in even a few dollars, this is how we do it grassroots, because the only way we can win is to do it ethically and morally.
Exactly. Chris, again, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, more on Mike Bloomberg. When it comes to Mike Bloomberg, I don't know if I've ever seen so much damaging information come out of a candidate in like a 24-hour period in my entire life. And so we've got a couple of stories we're gonna cover. One is a pretty big one, but I want you to understand that when we go through this, there were like 6 stories at the very least that we're not gonna have time to do. So we're gonna be covering it in the future. And the reason we need to do this sort of all at once is he waited as long as possible to launch his run. So we didn't, for all the other candidates, we had 8 months to go over their records, but he only launched at the end of last year. And so now all this stuff is showering all over us. So take a look at this. I mean, we've talked about some of his statements about the financial crisis, those sorts of things. But we're also finding out that some of the culture that he had when it came to female employees back in his business days, it's starting to look pretty Trumpian. So Democratic presidential candidate Mike Bloomberg allegedly told a female employee, quote, kill it, when she told him she was pregnant, according to the former Bloomberg executive's 1997 lawsuit. So there have been multiple lawsuits against him. It seems like there are a few that most of the details have come from. Others have been sort of hushed up, but kill it.
I don't know what to do with that. Because it's like, that's so intense. Like, I can't help but laugh. I shouldn't be. That is a real intense thing to say.
Because it's crazy.
Yeah, right. Because your body just goes like, nah, that's not real.
That's bad dialogue in a movie.
Couldn't have genuinely meant that.
No.
So yeah. Weird.
So let's talk about this lawsuit. It was filed in New York. Sakiko Sakai Garrison alleged Bloomberg followed up his first remark, which we said, with another offensive comment, quote, great, number 16, apparently referring to the number of pregnant employees on his payroll. Because apparently he's both incredibly frustrated when women get pregnant and also tracks the number. She says that he pointed out another woman to her and remarked, quote, if you looked like that, I would do you in a second. His references to him referring to female employees as, quote, meat. The suit accused Bloomberg of making racist remarks as well, including calling Mexican clients, quote, jumping beans, and telling a female employee who needed a nanny, quote, all you need is some black who doesn't even have to speak English to rescue it from a burning building. A sentence that I don't even understand. I don't know what that means, but it's definitely racist. I get that part.
I mean, it sounds like he's qualified to be president at this point.
Based on recent qualifications.
But like, I say that as a joke, but that's kind of what I see a lot of potential Bloomberg voters thinking. It's like, he's better than Trump. I'm so tired of losing to Trump that I want to beat Trump with someone who will anger Trump. And what it is.
That's the lib tears philosophy. That's the, I care about making the people who disagree with me suffer. Like, who do you care if like it would piss him off? No, I want someone who's actually gonna win. Like, I don't care if it frustrates Trump.
Right, but they think that this is the way to beat him, is to have like some lighter version of it that isn't, and before this information came out, that is just like someone who's richer than Trump from the same place as Trump and is a Democrat, like, I'll take it.
Recently.
That kind of thing. It's the desperation that people had. That was, I forget who it was on CNN who actually said this, that was like, they had Biden in their cart, but they hadn't checked out yet. And so Biden's looking in the cart like it's like falling apart in your cart. You're like, let's get rid of it.
Leaky bag of corn pops.
Yes. And so they're like, I guess I have to vote for Bloomberg because he is the one that has emerged, as I'm told, as the moderate. Uh-huh. He ran New York. That's executive experience. He has the money to go up against Trump. I'm not excusing this. I'm not. But what I think might happen is,
are you saying to my objections to Bloomberg, kill it effectively? Yeah, yeah.
No. I'm not saying that. I'm just trying to explain what I've seen from the people I've talked to about why they might be considering Bloomberg.
Yeah. I think maybe there's some of that. Although I would say if all you care about is getting rid of Trump because of how much you hate him and have for the past few years, and I totally get it. I hate him more than you do. But if that's what you believe, the idea that, well, let's get someone who's marginally better, but like so reminiscent of Trump in an increasing number of ways.
Well, not anymore. The argument that I heard from the Black Caucus members who endorsed him is like, he's not like that anymore.
Yeah, he apologized for stop and frisk back in November of last year.
Well, that's what they say. I'm not saying that I buy it.
And he doesn't say this stuff out loud anymore, but back when it was acceptable, he did. Okay, so look, I do want to his credit, he settled the lawsuit in 2000. He claimed to have passed a lie detector test in 2001, denying that he made the remark about the pregnancy. And I've seen multiple articles reference that lie detector test. I have never seen anyone who had evidence of what the lie detector, and again, it's not admissible, like all that stuff that you know. But it was he says he did it in private and then says, oh yeah, I passed it. Okay, but can we see it? No, you can't. I mean, that's Trumpian right there. What's the point of taking a lie detector test if we can't even see the results? Anyway, and that was in the lead up to 2001. So the thing was, this scandal breaking, like again, right before his first run for the mayor of New York, it didn't really hurt him because people barely care about this stuff now. They definitely didn't care in 2001.
Right.
Like, you were just allowed to do all this stuff. There was no Me Too movement on the horizon or anything. Theoretically, this sort of stuff seems like it should like at least be acknowledged at this point, considering all that we've been through.
We'll see what happens, because as they, you know, if he has this debate stage opportunity, nobody knows what he looks like on the debate stage because they haven't seen it happen since 2001. Mm-hmm. And he'll probably run in some way to say, like, listen, I atoned for my sins back then. I went into an election. And after that election, people said, I knew all that stuff, but I am fine with it. And he's going to use that as some
argument.
Kind of vindication. Whereas, like, the way that Bernie Sanders supporters have always viewed Bernie is like, well, You guys seem to have a lot of trouble with Bloomberg because you have to excuse past behavior that was wishy-washy and weird and contrary to how he presents him now. And the joy of being a Bernie Sanders supporter is you don't have to excuse the candidate's statements he made 40 years ago because they're the same statements he's making today.
Yeah. Yeah, and like I could throw out so many like individual, like he endorsed George W. Bush. Like that was not like that. George W. Bush, he was fundraising for Republican candidates like 3 years ago.
But this is like all privilege.
Like he wanted them to control the Senate, and now he's gonna be a Democrat who's gonna be constrained by the Senate he helped get them.
This stuff is what privilege is like. It's just like, yeah, I know I did it, but come on, let me still.
Yeah, yeah. Jeez, so frustrating. We don't
do it.
Have much time. Okay, super fast. Okay. Mike Bloomberg, in the run-up to running for mayor back in 2001, he had a bit of trouble that he had to clear up, and he attempted. So 2 months before announcing his bid, he quietly began resigning from four exclusive clubs in Manhattan and Westchester County that have predominantly white memberships. Also, you'll be shocked to find out, male memberships. And at the time, Arthur Levitt, who was a member of one of the clubs with Bloomberg, said, "I think there are probably a limited number of non-Jewish members. I have seen blacks and I have seen Hispanics, but I have no idea whether they are members or not. Somebody told me there was a black member, but you could hardly say there was lavish representation of the black or Hispanic community at Century or at any other club for that matter." So it was an issue, and he was actually asked about it at one of the debates. So I went and watched that full debate. Here is his response to a question about him leaving those clubs.
"In terms of clubs, I joined a few clubs that were created because other people couldn't get in to the clubs they wanted to, so they created their own. Some changed when I was in, some did not. When they didn't change as much as they should, I got out of those clubs before I ran. I didn't have to wait for somebody to tell me to go and investigate something. I knew what was right. I did it, and it was done long before I started running for office."
Okay, Mr. Green?
"I never had to quit all white clubs because I never joined them."
I just want to include that because
that
was
a good
funny
answer.
Yeah. What Bloomberg said was 100% a lie.
No.
No, it is. I left it long before I started running. He left it a couple months before he hit a run.
The part that's not a lie is like the Jewish clubs. Like there's plenty of.
No,
I have
saying,
a lot of problems with
said,
all of this, but.
He said, "I didn't need to be told to leave. I looked, and when they didn't change,
yeah, that's all
I left." No, you joined after, like, in some cases, more than a half century of this sort of exclusive membership. You joined it knowing that they had that. You only left a couple of months before running for mayor because you knew it was going to be an issue. So to present that as some sort of principled stand,
yeah, it's the same
is
thing
insane.
He did. It's the same thing he's done with Stop and Frisk. It's like, well, I quit them when I realized I wanted to be this office.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, I want to get to the punchline though, as it's been alluded to in the lower third. Afterward, he went back to those clubs, by the way. New York Post page 6 noted in 2014 that he had rejoined the Century Club, a predominantly white club in Purchase, New York. He also put his children up for membership because why not? He doesn't care anymore at that point. He wasn't running for anything at that point. So he just got back into it.
Yeah, that's.
But what about the whole, "I didn't need to be told what was wrong. I looked and they wouldn't change."
That's an absolute lie.
Yeah.
The only thing, yeah, there and also like if you had inclusive clubs, they're still exclusive clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is the most like progressive $250,000 a year club I could be a part of where we get to go play golf at night. And they put lights up for us, and we have all the poor people hold flashlights and shine them.
Is that really?
No, but like, but like that kind of stuff. It is even the most inclusive racially and gender wise country club is still exclusivity.
Yeah, yeah. And I want really fast one other anecdote about what these clubs are like. So one, the Century Club, that's one of the ones he rejoined. So I read an account from Eleanor Guggenheimer. So she had been a member of that club since 1946 when she said this in 2001. So she said the club has come a long way in other areas. Like the treatment of women, although she said it still did not permit women on the golf course in the early mornings on the presumption that they didn't work and could play later in the day. She had been a member of the club for more than a half a century and loved it, but she acknowledged, well, you know, they don't let me play until later because they assume none of us have any jobs because we're women.
That's
that was in
so
2001.
Weird. So what can they
That's
show?
The club he rejoined.
That's amazing. It's so amazing. It's like, what if they didn't have work? What if they did? No, who's working? If you play golf in the early mornings, by the way, like, you're not done till like 11:30 a.m. And now you have to, if you had work, that's work time. Normal people are at work then.
Yeah.
None of you have work.
And none of them have regular jobs. They're paying $250 million, as you pointed out. Okay, there'll be more on him in the future. We do have to go to a break though. Stick around after this. Joining us now is congressional candidate for New York's 13th district, James Felton Keith. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you on. Excited to talk about a number of topics with you. Before we get into some of the topical stuff, though, I did want to start off with your slogan, which is "We Owe Us." Can you tell us about that?
"We Owe Us" is hip hop, baby. I mean, at the end of the day, our slogan is around in our campaign is around ownership, the distribution of it, and how we include people in this economy. And so We Owe Us just really, it came out of a rally that we had a few years ago. Mm-hmm. I've technically been running for Congress since 2017, and everyone just started chanting "We Owe Us" as we talked about economic inclusion and equity specific to the land we live on here in Manhattan and parts of the Bronx and a variety of other things. So We Owe Us just started happening, and we stuck with it because it's hip hop.
So I totally get the philosophy. What are some of the positions, the policies that have sprung from this starting point?
Well, sure. I mean, so our core policy is universal basic income and other sorts of basic incomes. So I'm a strong cannabis legalization advocate, a strong Medicare for all, and education reform, whether it's specific to universal pre-K or education subsidies for public schools, a strong advocate for climate action of a variety of sorts. And We Owe Us really came around making our political villain ourselves. When we look at least the sort of representatives that we've had here in Northern Manhattan and the Northwest Bronx, they've sort of sat on these issues and given them a lot of lip service over the years, but have taken no real risk to make changes. And so We Owe Us was more about making ourselves the political villain instead of, say, Trump's immigrants or, you know, Bernie's corporations or Andrew Yang's automation. Our real villain was us, and we were asking ourselves, are we willing to sort of duke it out to, you know, die on the stake for what we believe in, or rather what we're owed?
You know, so I love the way that you're framing that, but I am curious. So outside of the initial place and the people who were there when you came up with that, when you presented that way to voters, how do they respond to that challenge? Do they get what you're trying to say? What do they think about that as a philosophy?
You know, the younger folks are excited about it, and the older folks are like, run, young man, run. I sort of fit into this interesting new space. A few weeks ago, this 20, I'm assuming she was about 20 years old, she said, "I think you're the oldest millennial I know." And I just thought, sure, I'll wear that. So I'm in this interesting spot where I recognize that I'm significantly older than a couple of adults, but the old guard, especially here in Harlem, the old black guard, they look at me like, this kid wants to run for Charlie Rangel's old seat, or now, you know, Espaillat's seat. And, it's an interesting dynamic of how everyone responds. But I do think that the older folks are inspired by the younger folks and their energy. And we've seen that time and time again in American politics. So I think it's necessary. Yeah.
So in the same way that your slogan sort of is a totally different spin on how normally the people we have on the show talk about these sorts of things, you have some other terms that I would love to find out more about. So tell me about techno-Gaian policies.
Oh, techno-Gaian, yeah. Well, what specifically, it's more of an ecological stance on how we distribute ecological resources, how we cater to those. I think you may be talking about it's a portion of our inclusionism platform. Right. So my core biopolitical philosophy is called inclusionism, and it's really geared around three core principles. The idea that people have an intrinsic value first, that they only derive that value from interactions with each other second, and that they are entitled to some equity in the value that proliferates from that interaction, third. And if we're just talking specific to our ecology, I think the real objective for humans is to control everything, right? So we want to control how we build sustainability, not only in to our economy or our ecology, but you know, across the you know celestial and terrestrial bodies that we engage. I'm a humanist, and I think that our objective should be to leverage all of the latest tech to make sure that we live here for as long as possible.
You know, there's so many individual policies I want to get into that'll probably have to come in a follow-up interview. But one area that I am curious about, you mentioned Andrew Yang and you support UBI. He's done a great job of elevating that as a thing that people are at the very least aware of. So I'm curious, how does your plan? What are the overlaps and what are some of the differences between the way you might approach that and the way Andrew Yang has been describing it over the last year?
Sure. I think the biggest differences are just what an executive can do and what a legislator would have to do. But, you know, early days, I was introduced to Andrew by a guy named Andy Stern, who used to be the president of the largest labor union here in the U.S., to really advise them and communicate to them how we were thinking about how we may achieve a universal basic income. And while there are many sorts of basic incomes I'd like to see enacted at the state and municipal level, the universality that would reach all Americans, I think, really comes down to providing them with a new property that is specific to their input to overall economic productivity here. And the way we do that is really through a series of cyber and data laws that we've been passing at the state level and in Europe and Asia over the course of the past 2 years. My method for a universal basic income is really to give everyone an equity stake or a dividend in all corporate productivity, period. I'm not as interested in a tax plan or moving social safety net or welfare programs over. I think there's another bucket of money that we don't engage at all that has nothing to do with housing, healthcare, education, social safety net programs. And so, So I'm excited about being able to achieve some of those goals. I think they're a lot more achievable than people think because a lot of the infrastructure to argue that people are owed a piece of the economic productivity has already been built into our laws nationally and at the state level and at the municipal level.
Okay, so, I mean it's fascinating. Hopefully in the near future we can you know dig into more of your platform. But James Felton Keith, really appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
We're going to take one last break here, and then when we come back, close out the week as we have been recently with the Garbage People of the Week. It's the end of the week, and it's time to take out the trash. Here are the Garbage People of the Week. As always, Brett Ehrlich joins me. We've each chosen a garbage person. Brett, who's the trashiest this week?
I thought about going to Trump because I haven't in a while.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to go with Bill Barr.
Oh.
Bill Barr is my garbage person of the week because Bill Barr decided this week that he was going to kind of make this big move against Trump by going in an interview and saying Trump is making it impossible to do my job.
That was great. How's your like garbage
because
person?
He doesn't
that
need
was
great. It because it was just an orchestrated thing. Today he's going into the Michael Flynn investigation and unleashing his own people on the prosecutors who prosecuted Flynn.
Okay, that would normally bother me, but yesterday he said something bad about Trump.
He pulls a single page out of Collins Murkowski's book, which is, yeah. I'm going to say things that make you think I'm reasonable, but every other action I take will counteract that.
Garbage person.
Garbage.
Yeah, that page he took out of the book, the header was the bare minimum, yeah. I think. That's a good choice. Mine was very easy. Sometimes it's hard. This is very easy. My garbage person of the week is Chuck Todd.
Yeah.
Because of how unrepentantly biased and dishonest he is about Bernie Sanders. I mean, this isn't even just for the like calling his supporters brown shirts. And I know he didn't technically call them that, but he read a quote so that he could say it, and then he didn't in any way have a problem with it. But then the bizarre, like willful lack of understanding of what makes a front runner. Mm-hmm. Like
he definitely considers himself to not be one of those opinionated people like a Maddow or a Sean Hannity or whatever, me or you or whatever. He's just a news guy. And yet he is as deranged and biased as any opinion political analyst.
Yeah. Chuck Todd, you think you're so smart.
You think
you're
so
smarter than this, Chuck Todd.
Yeah, exactly. How you like them apples, Chuck Todd?
Yeah, I forgot about Chuck Todd's multiple moments this week.
Both good choices.
Willful deniability.
Okay, well, those are the garbage people, and thus the trash is taken out. Brett, thank you as always. Working through your vertigo.
Thank you. I didn't fall over. But you know, we got about 15 seconds left in show. So
hey, if you need to spew.
Spew into this. Everybody watch Happy Half Hour this evening. Sam Dingman on the show. And
then
you go to tyt.com/bespoke and use Turks20 at checkout.
Do that. Okay, thank you everybody. See you on Monday.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/tyt. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.